I dream of a cleansing wave. I return to form. That's Knock Loose. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Kyle Schwarber has got that cleansing wave. He has returned to form. Another home run last night, tying Alfonso Soriano's 2003 Major League record with the New York Yankees with 13 leadoff home runs this season. We are, of course, intimately familiar with that stat from a career perspective because George Springer is second all-time. Ricky Henderson is obviously the all-time leader. That is a stat that Jays fans know well career-wise. But yeah, Kyle Schwarber now tied with Alfonso Soriano with 13 in one season. He's got 20-plus games here to get number 14 and knock 0-3 Soriano off that ledger. Soriano's come up a few times as of late as well, because obviously Shohei just reached the 40-40 plateau, which Alfonso Soriano did in 2006, and then was one homer off in 2002, was just a couple homer and stolen base off in 03 and 05. Alfonso Soriano, man, that peak from 2002 to 2007 or so is something else. Pretty remarkable stuff. And yeah, in that 03 season where he ended up hitting 38 home runs overall, 13 of them of the leadoff variety. The Kyle Schwarber leadoff home run was not all the Phillies needed yesterday, but they didn't need much more. Cody Clemens hit a two-run shot in the second inning, and then the Phillies added an insurance run with a JT Realmuto home run off Ryan Burr in the ninth. That was all the offense they needed. They went 4-2. The Jays put up two runs in the first inning with three doubles. Double for Varsho, double for Vlad, double for Kirk, and that's it. They're pretty much Christopher Sanchez and the bullpen, Jeff Hoffman and Carlos Estevez, cruising from there. So the Jays get swept in a two-gamer against the Phillies. This is a Phillies team that's now won 9 of their last 11, so even though they're a little dinged up in the position player side, and they had to move Taijuan Walker to the bullpen, and they got a bad two-thirds of an inning start from Tyler Phillips in the first part of this series, Phillies keep rolling. 9 of their last 11, they're 7 up in the NL East, and they are a half game off the Dodgers for the best record in the NL, which would, of course, be home field throughout the National League side of the playoffs, and you get the bye through the first round and things like that. So nice to wave goodbye to the Phillies. The Jays are off today, their second off day of the week. They will see the Braves Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They're on the road, just a quick homestand there. We don't know the starters for sure, but it looks like Kevin Gausman against Max Fried, Jose Berríos against Spencer Schwellenbach, and Yariel Rodriguez against likely NL Cy Young winner Chris Sale. Let's talk to Keegan Matheson of BlueJays.com about all of it. Keegan, how are we doing this morning, buddy?
I'm doing well, Blake. How you doing?
I'm good, man. So Kyle Schwarber, he's fixed, I guess. The talk, it's always funny how these things go, where obviously we're so Jays focused and Jays centric, and then the Phillies come in and you're pregame on Tuesday talking to some of their writers or some of the people around their team, and they're like, yeah, Schwarber's kind of struggling, like hasn't hit righties really well, and now he's leaving town, and the next team they go visit, you know, I can't remember if it's Miami or Tampa Bay, but somewhere Florida, those people are going to be like, yeah, Kyle Schwarber's really hot right now. Quick turnaround for Schwarbs there.
Yeah, that's what a real team looks like, I guess. The Phillies are really good, and they're really fun, and they know they're good, which makes it even better. And Schwarber, Blake, I think burly leadoff hitter or DH leadoff hitter might be my version of a perfect baseball player.
Yeah.
It's just watching Kyle Schwarber, especially his third home run. Think back to game one, that third home run, that long at-bat he had against Chad Green. I know if you're a Blue Jays fan, you did not enjoy that, but that was great baseball. Man, to end, and he didn't get a cheap one. Like, he launched that third home run. That was amazing to watch. And Schwarber has long been one of my favorite players to watch in this league play. Man, what he's been able to do first with the Cubs and with Philly, it's amazing. He's the guy you want to top your lineup. He may not look like that traditional leadoff hitter, Blake, but it reminds me a year ago, as you were talking off the top, Blake, we were at Fenway Park. And media in a lot of stadiums leaves out the same door the players do, which leads to a lot of disappointed faces when this walks out the door. We were walking out of Fenway Park, which is very small, and the players park right next to it. And the fans were chanting the names of players as they walked out. And then I walked out, and in the most Boston accent possible, I hear a guy go, "We got Schwarber back!" And they started a Schwarber chant as I walked by. So it was, I guess we're made in the same factory. Not nearly as talented, but big guy DHs leading off a lineup. That's the ideal roster construction. I don't care what the analytics say.
I mean, the analytics like a guy who has a 371 OBP in the leadoff spot. Like, you, like, the home runs are obviously nice as well. It's great. 13 times this year, the Phillies, hey, here's a run. before we even have an out. That part is great too. The analytics will always be in favor of runs on the board. Yeah. But even if he wasn't hitting all those dingers, 371 on base at the top. I will push back a little bit on this on your behalf and you know, on my behalf as well, John Schneider's behalf. There's not that much physical similarity between you and a Kyle Schwarber. You and Schneider's, I get it a little bit more, but like, you know, you guys have kind of the same haircut as well, or roughly the same haircut. But it's gone a little too far of like every guy of a certain shape and beard looks the same. It's
any guy with facial hair over 200 pounds is the same guy, just like any bald guy, I guess. So
it's why I don't wear my glasses when you come on the show now. I was tired of the people tagging it. It's like, oh, this guy's talking to himself. Okay, so Kyle Schwarber turns that around. We hear him talk about, or we see stories out of the Phillies people talking about the work he's done with Kevin Long. We heard Chris Bassett talk about Kevin Long, the Phillies hitting coach, the other day, who was the hitting coach when Bassett was with the New York Mets as well. Obviously a healthy respect there for him from both sides. What do you make of this Phillies? You said it off the top, that's what a good lineup looks like. Where this Phillies team can get to, you know, half a game back of the Dodgers now atop the NL. We obviously saw them make a good run the last 2 years. Are you buying on this Phillies team, you know, 4 weeks from now?
Yeah, I love this Phillies team. I love their lineup. It's fun to watch. And the bar I typically use, Blake, is if I'm getting home and they're playing a West Coast game, will I watch them? I'll watch the Phillies. The Dodgers are probably the one other team. It's you know, and after a day at the ballpark, sometimes I'm not rushing to turn on more baseball. So it's got to be worth my while. The Phillies are that, because not only are they really good, they have a great leadoff hitter, great power through the middle with Harper and others, but they're entertaining. There's a bit of an attitude to it all. There's a real attitude to it all. Some of that coming from Castellanos and a lot of those other players, but it works, man. And it's a team that fits its city. I know this doesn't matter for wins and losses. I love it when a team kind of fits a city, and the Phillies certainly fit Philadelphia with the attitude they have. I love it when that happens in any sport. And the Phillies, man, if they make another postseason run, that's as fun a city when things are going well as you can find in pro sports. Now, when things are going bad, they're going to boo Santa and throw snowballs and beer bottles at you. At least they care, you know. So when the Phillies make a run, and I think they will, that's going to be fascinating to watch. That's a series I'd love to be on and being close to that.
Yeah, and look, the Phillies visiting the West Coast is one thing you can turn on. We both also know we're like 2 weeks away from WNBA playoffs, and the NFL season starts tonight. We know what's going to dominate your television in the background there, and it's probably not going to be West Coast regular season baseball. We'll wait for that to roll around. On the Blue Jays side, Kyle Schwarber tees off on a Bowden Francis one there. Kobe Clemens got to him for a home run as well. What did you make of Bowden Francis' start? This is the first time in a while we've seen him kind of deal with adversity early in a game. That had been a story when he first came back up as a starter. Hey, you weren't getting off to the best starts. Could you round it out? Could you give us some length still? Yesterday, he kind of shakes that off, ends up giving them six, three earned, six hits, no walks. Not bad, all things considered, I guess, right? Even though he did make a couple mistakes there.
Yeah, this is the kind of start that you realistically want to have from him next year. Now, yeah, you'd love him to almost throw a no-hitter every single time. It's not going to happen. But look at what an average number five starter is in Major League Baseball. A lot of teams do not have a number five. They're cycling through guys using 10 or 12 starters all season. If Bowden Francis can give the Blue Jays a bunch of outings with this stat line next year, and maybe an inch better, but this stat line, you're pretty happy. For him to be able to bounce back from those early home runs was impressive. And again, you don't want to make up tests for the sake of having tests, but I did want to see this with Francis down the stretch, him run into some trouble early on and then get it back together and get himself through a decent outing. That was pretty impressive to me, especially that breaking ball you just showed there on that strikeout. I thought was fantastic. That was a big pitch in a big spot. And you're seeing what Chris Bassett, what John Schneider, what everyone else says about Bowden Francis is that you can't really shake the guy. And he is such a unique personality. I think Blue Jays fans know that well by now. But this guy could give up 100 runs in the first inning, and he'd be walking to the mound in the second with that cool, calm smile on his face. Not because he doesn't care. He cares just as much as anybody. But it's an ability to separate that, which is very important to starting pitching. And you hear players say that a lot. I think I've started to appreciate that that's true. I think it's taken me some years to appreciate how much that does actually matter. And it's taken me seeing some pitchers who have not separated that as well, you know, starters and relievers. When you see a guy not separating it, my God, you see it everywhere. You see it at 3 o'clock in the clubhouse. It's all over a guy. Bowden Francis can separate really well. And this is, for my dollar, Blake, I think the story of the season right now at this point for the Blue Jays, because it impacts so much of the winter coming up. If Bowden Francis can be a legit starter, that's another example that I think he is.
Yeah, and look, it's, you know, it's possible. Hey, if his last three or four starts here were what they look like at the start of the season, that's going to recontextualize. Oh, people caught up to the splitter or the fastball, yeah, you know, is figured out or whatever. But if it's a couple more, hey, 3-6, 2-5 and a third kind of starts, he's going to be in a pretty comfortable spot. The other thing that Bowden Francis has going for him that I don't know that we've talked a lot about, hey, could you get Bassett, Gausman, Berríos an extra day down? The Jays are going to manage Yariel Rodriguez's workload with, hey, maybe he only throws three innings. You know, there was talk the other day of if Jake Bloss comes up at some point, maybe it's a piggyback situation with someone, and they didn't say specifically, I would imagine it's Yariel given the innings concern. But Bowden Francis had 104 innings over AAA in the majors this year. He only threw 66 total last year, but it was 99 the year before that. It was over 130 in the minor leagues the year before that. Obviously, he's a large dude who has shown he can, you know, carry his stuff into the ninth inning when there's a no-hit bid and he's well over 100 pitches. You know, only 89 pitches last night. But there's no concern with this, right? Like, Bowden Francis is going to start and start as long as he can go the rest of the way here.
I think so, yeah. Bowden does seem like he's built for it. He is, even more than I appreciate sometimes, a really well-built pitcher. I don't know exactly how tall he is. I'm 6'2". He's taller than me, so he's above that. And he is well-built, broad-shouldered. He can really carry this workload. I think he is built for that and hasn't shown too many warning signs. I haven't really seen any red flags of him slowing down. If he can get, Blake, what are we, September 5th, if he can get just over 120 innings and have a good, healthy offseason, next year you're looking at a guy who can go maybe 150. And in 2025, that's like going 200 innings a few years back. 150 is enough, man, at this point in Major League Baseball. And he set himself up pretty well for that. Coming into the year, getting up to 120-plus for Bowden would not have been a favorite bet, probably. But looks like he's done this. And especially with Yariel down the stretch, I like a lot of what we've seen from Yariel. We clearly need to see more. That's clearly still a situation in flux as he develops. Having Bowden as a legitimate starter feels more important by the week, really, at this point.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, the 125 innings would have been a long shot bet. It actually was. I came on with Sho Ali in the preseason, and Bowden throwing 125 was my bold prediction for the season. He's not going to get there. He's not going to get there in major league innings, but it's going to be close enough. The other safest bet, so he is Grateful Dead night, the giveaway night, is 7 games from now, and he pitched last night, so he's not going to start. They would have to juggle the rotation too many different ways. It's not going to happen. But is there a safer bet than a Sportsnet camera shot of him in the bucket hat, the Grateful Dead dancing bear bucket hat, in the dugout that night? Is there a safer bet on the board rest of the season?
Absolutely. He'll have the beaded bracelets on, the necklaces. He will have his the old school headphones on, listening to some 78-minute Grateful Dead or Fish jam song. Man, Grateful Dead night. They should have lined that up, man. They need Bowden Francis on Grateful Dead night. That would be a no-hitter. I would bet on that.
Okay, so you mentioned necklaces there. This is completely aside. It's not even in my notes to ask. Okay. Have you noticed the re-explosion of the fighting necklaces around the Blue Jays? Including, like, I saw one sitting off to the side in John Schneider's office the other day. David Schneider's back in them now. What's going on here, man? It's 2010.
Yeah, what are they and why? I don't get it. I feel like I should go back to, like, our high school days, Blake, and go to a Blue Notes and get one of those necklaces, you know, the puka shell or those weird things we used to wear. Yeah, those are back, man. I've never quite understood them. I'm a baseball writer, so I'm not a man of great style myself, but maybe I should chuck one on for a game, see if I write a better story or something. But they're back. They're back.
I played reasonably competitive slow pitch for a couple summers, and like right at the peak of everyone's got fighting necklaces, I had a red and a black, depending on what, you know, jersey you were going with that day.
Oh, baby.
My ions have never been so positively charged or negatively aligned, whatever the thing they're supposed to do to your ions. Yeah. It's fun. Okay. You wrote a great piece this week about Dalton Varsho, and he had a double in that first inning yesterday. Jays didn't put a lot of offense on the board, but he was a part of that. Obviously, homered in the first inning the day before. What are you seeing click at the plate for him right now? He's gotten, you know, good stretch earlier in the year, another cold stretch, and now he's got that season line back above league average here. What have you seen?
I see a guy making more contact finally at this point. I think it was a 360 plus on base percentage in August, which is fantastic for him. That's always the number I care about with Dalton Varsho. He's going to hit for power. And he's not a big built guy. He's not a tall guy, but he's extremely powerful, extremely strong with his base. So when he's making contact, he's going to hit for power. He's a pretty safe bet to hit 20, 22 home runs just about every year. And he has. But it's that career on base that hovers around 300 that keeps him from being a legitimate star in this league. I'm not just talking about an elite defender who hits for power. I'm talking about a star that people talk about if he can get that on base percentage up. Now, it does not need to turn into Ricky Henderson overnight. That's not going to happen. But we see from him the chaos he can create on the bases with the speed he has, the aggression, and I think the intelligent base running that he has. So even getting Dalton on base a little bit more would be a really good thing for this team. He is finishing strong. He looks fantastic in center field like he always does. He could do that with his eyes closed. And what I wrote a bit about, Blake, is that I think people are finally maybe getting enough distance from that trade to view Dalton Varsho for what he is, which is a real good ball player and a center fielder that a lot of teams in this league would love to have on their roster.
Yeah, it's out of mind for the time being until Arizona's back in the playoffs again and Gabriel Moreno.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Gabriel Moreno's been hurt the last couple weeks, but it's crazy. Like, I think he's thrown out 16 of 52 base runners this year. And then since he hit the IL, the Diamondbacks have, like, almost not thrown out a single base runner. They're, like, opposing teams are, like, 30 for 32 against them or something like that since Moreno went down. It's bad. Anyway, Varsho is good. I'm probably not buying on the OBP turnaround big picture, but if you could get it north of 300 for a season line, awesome.
Yeah, because, just a little bit.
Yeah, little bit. I mean, with his defensive base running, if you hit low 20s home runs and can get that OBP up to 315, 320, we're talking about a four-win player. It's not, like, given the defense and the base running, it's not, you know, the climb for him to be a really valuable piece is not that high. This leads me somewhere else, and when we start to, this is maybe more of an off-season conversation, but when we start to look at, like, we know the Jays need to add offensive punch. Probably a couple of impact bats. When we're looking at how all of that fits, you know, a batting order is something, you know, we'll see who comes in the door. Like, obviously, if it's Anthony Santander, that looks one way. If it's Alex Bregman, that looks another way. If it's three guys who are, you know, 70% of those guys, it looks a different way. What do you think is, Like, how would you head into the offseason when you look at the seasons that Springer, Varsho, and Bo have had where, you know, Springer's season line a little below league average and a 300-ish, sub-300 OBP. Mm-hmm. Varsho, again, line back above league average, but an OBP right around 300. Like, we've talked a lot about middle-of-the-order stuff, but the Jays are also lacking a little bit in the table setter at the top of the order. How are they going to navigate that, or you just get the guys and let the rest fall where it may?
Yeah, you'd love to have the on-base guy up top, and they've tried that with Spencer Horwitz. But then again, if Spencer Horwitz is only going to play first base and DH, which it sounds like now, maybe that's not as everyday of a fit for the Blue Jays. You'd love to have that classic leadoff man who's getting on base in front of Vladdy, because Vladdy is worth getting on base in front of. Again, he's going to drive guys in. Now, if Bo can be that, fantastic, but Bo Bichette's also a player who can hit 300 and OBP 310. You know, it's not exactly his game. That's okay. That doesn't need to be the beauty of his game. But the on-base, I think, needs to be a priority for this team, just in front of Vladdy. Yes, they need a lot more power, my goodness. But I keep coming back to the outfield, Blake, like, because you mentioned Springer and Varsho. Those guys aren't going anywhere. But left field, for a long time, has felt like the opportunity to upgrade this offense, maybe. That's where you find a power bat. Maybe I spent too many years watching Teoscar Hernandez out there, maybe, but that feels like a position where you can add some power, where you can add a little bit of on base. And they need something. You know, there's a lot that needs to happen this offseason, but my goodness, this offense needs a legitimate. I'm not talking about going getting Brandon Belt or Justin Turner again. I don't know who's 39 and free agent this year. I'm sure there's somebody. You need to get a legitimate bat who can change a game, who can flip a game, because they haven't had that next to Vladdy these last couple of years. And then if Bo bounces back, fantastic. You've got three of them. But it seems like that's needs to be a real priority, not just the power, but like you say, the on-base, because there's not been enough of that in front of Vlad.
Yeah, and I think you're right to focus it on left field, because you look at what's available at other positions. Well, Matt Chapman just signed a six-year extension with the Giants last night for $151 mil. So the third base pool is Alex Bregman, and then a huge gap, and then like Gleyber Torres, Yoan Moncada, Eugenio Suarez. Like you could add Ha-Sung Kim and juggle guys around and stuff because he's so good defensively, but it gets like you get to Gio Urshela's name at third base way quicker than you would like to get to Gio Urshela's name. What did you make when you saw that Chapman news? And we'll talk more about it in the show with John Morosi as well. But interesting offseason for him signing that like 1+1+1 deal. Looks like it all worked out. 6-1-51 to stick with the Giants.
It was surprising to wake up to. When I woke up and immediately did morning scroll on the phone, which is a very healthy way to start the day, and it's not stressful at all. And seeing the Matt Chapman news, I had to search it up and double, triple check that. I was very surprised. You don't typically see big contracts, big extensions signed on midnight, September 4th. It's not typically how this works. Now, good for Matt Chapman. He gets what he wants. He gets paid. He gets San Francisco. Great place to be. Good on him. This has been a very good year for him. When you look at his wins above replacement, I think he can push up past 5 by the end of the year. If you are the Giants, are you going to love the offense you get in years 3, 4, 5, 6? I don't know. But in a perfect world, you get all of your value early up front. Kind of a similar conversation to the George Springer contract back when he signed that. The idea was you win a championship, you go on a run in those first 3, 4 years. And if the back end is bad, so what? You got a banner up there. We'll see how this works out for the Giants. But Matt Chapman, it took a while. He got what he was looking for. And it's going to be an interesting one to monitor, because you're talking about a player whose value is so deeply tied to his defense. And that's not the typical case we're talking about. We're typically talking about, can a guy sustain his power? Can he sustain bat speed? This is much different. And the Giants were aggressive. That's the word I'll call this. Yeah, they were aggressive with this move.
Yeah, and you factor in this year as well. And it turns out he got 7 years, 179 after leaving Toronto, which pretty good. I don't know that, even though Chapman's having a really good year and the Jays have had a bad one, I don't know that if you went back to this offseason, if anyone would jump on 7, 179. For him. And obviously that's not a fair comp because he got the rolling options and things like that. Yeah. But it is interesting the way that's played out. And now third base is thin. Okay, Keegan, you mentioned you woke up this morning and you start your day by scrolling. It's NFL opening day. I know how you opened your day. You looked at three or four fantasy lineups to see if there was any news over the night. How did fantasy draft season treat you?
Beautifully. Just beautiful. I've got them up in front of me here. I'm going to spend my day with it. And I was explaining this to my girlfriend earlier. Sometimes when you open up your fantasy app or your lineup, you're not doing anything. You're just checking in on the guys.
Just see how they are.
You're looking for that little orange square next to the name. Oh, is something going on with you today? I check on them like they're my friends. They're my living, breathing friends in this world. It's a good night, baby. I'm excited. The Packers start tomorrow, the true team in the NFL. It's going to be a good couple of days. I will not be in Atlanta. God bless. And I've got nothing but NFL football to look forward to. There's a couch to my left here, and I am not going to leave that until Monday, about 3 p.m., Mets Blue Jays. So I'll get up when John Gibbons comes to town.
Yeah, Packers Eagles in Brazil on Friday is a nice way to start the season. Speaking of the Packers, by the way, I was talking football with Dalton Varsho the other day, and I know everything I need to know about that Packers team now. Like, I know the offensive line. How does Josh Jacobs fit? He was asking me like in detail about the Jaguars. What do you think of Trevor Lawrence, the Brian Thomas fit? What's Etienne's upside this year? That's a guy who knows his ball. So you and I both kind of kicked around with a couple of the guys. The Jays did their fantasy draft on Monday without giving away too many of the state secrets there. The inner workings. What have we learned about those guys from finding out about, like, there are some funny anecdotes, but like, no, everyone is playing to type the way I would have expected, like in terms of which fantasy stereotype are you?
Absolutely. You have the extremely serious managers who are picking apart waiver rules and getting all over stuff. And then you have the emotional managers who we could compare to, you know, our buddy from high school who's a big Bills fan or something. And they see that first overall pick, and in their mind, they say, Josh Allen's probably going to win the MVP. Why would I not draft him 101? So there's a it's a league, Blake. I'll explain it like similar to how I explain my old high school buddies' leagues. There are some competitive leagues that you go in to really enjoy them. An old high school buddies league or a college buddies league, there's a couple of them that you go in and you can look around and say, you know what, you're going to be a bit emotional on this. I can probably beat you. So there's a, I think if someone's a real sharp, like Dalton Varsho, I would bet money on him. He is a man of fine, fine taste in the state of Wisconsin. And B, he's a man who knows his stuff. So I think he could take advantage of some of the more emotional drafters, we will call them. And we'll see next spring. It was Tim Mesa last year who came last place and needed to be the bat boy. So maybe I'm covering that again in 6 months.
Yeah, although it's going to be a weirder one. So by the way, I will reveal this much. Varsho had he had pick 101 and he went Christian McCaffrey, as you have to do. So, you know, no funny business there. I do know there's a certain someone who has a couple of Bills on his roster who I think people could guess based on what his walkout music used to be and everything. But yeah, there are also guys like sharing teams because like obviously there was a ton of turnover in the league. More like half the Jays roster isn't here anymore from the start of the year. So yeah, there's split ownership and stuff. I don't even know if the guys who own teams will be here in spring training. How do you punish a guy like that? Like, I'm trying to play out a scenario in my head where, like, I don't know, Brian Servin has to be the bat boy, but he's actually on the opposing team and has to do it. The Danny Jansen Red Sox thing, but for fantasy football rules.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody's going to get thrown at, but it'll just be like a 70-mile-an-hour pitch in spring training. There'll have to be something, but I don't know if it'll get better than Tim Mesa. The amount of effort he put into being a bat boy, the earnestness with which he approached his task that day was unmatched.
Do any of your leagues have a stipulation like that, like a sacco, like a last place punishment?
See, we don't do a punishment league, and I wish we did because I'm a very safe fantasy player. So I don't win much, but I don't come last much. You know, I should probably take more risks in both fantasy and in life. But I would like to see it. I like the ones where people have to sit in. You know, you see the classic where they need to go to a Waffle House and eat a pancake to shave off an hour for 24 hours.
Oh, that sounds terrible. By eating 24 pancakes.
And I've seen similar ones where somebody has to go to a bar when it opens and you have to stay until it closes, but you shave off 30 minutes with each beer or something like that. Some of these sound okay, quite frankly, but I might need to institute one. But I'm glad the Blue Jays have one. Because come February, I'll be a man needing a story, I tell you.
You absolutely will. Yeah, I don't have any of those either. This is a part of the drawback of keeper leagues, right? Especially more serious ones. Yeah. It's like, well, you can't really do that because, I don't know. I'm the commissioner in my home league, and we've had to tweak the rules over the years to, like, limit tanking and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So then you get it. So now, like, the you don't want to come last, not because of that, but because you don't get the number one pick if you finish dead last. Number one pick goes to the best non-playoff team. So things like that kind of take that away from it a little bit. Anyway, best of luck to your Packers tomorrow.
Hey, you too.
Best of luck to your four fantasy teams and all your little guys. I hope they're well when you check in on them 10 times throughout today.
I appreciate you, brother. Thank you.
Keegan Matheson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. One other minor note from yesterday's game, wasn't worth going in too much detail with Keegan on, but Addison Barger sat out. He did tweak his knee, some knee discomfort from his kind of where he ran over. He's playing third base, but he's in the shortstop spot, picks up the ball, runs over to second, and then throws the runner out at first. Really great play. Tweaked his knee on that. So some discomfort there, but it didn't sound like anything too much. He's got an off day today. We'll see if there's an update tomorrow. Not much cooking down at the minor league level yesterday either. Paolo Espino did clear waivers and was outrighted to AAA, so he remains in the organization if they need a long man or something like that. We'll take a break. When we come back, we are going to talk to the pitching ninja, Rob Friedman. We'll talk to John Morosi and Jesse Rogers in the second hour as well. We'll also do some of your texts. There's no game to set up tonight, so text us 590, 590. How you feeling about the team? What do you want to see the next couple weeks? What do you think of the Chapman deal, et cetera, whatever is on your mind on this lovely Thursday. Standard data and message rates may apply, but hit us up. 590, 590. All that is coming up as Jays Talk Plus continues. Pitching Ninja next on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, a little frightened rabbit, good arms versus bad arms. That is basically the life of our next guest, finding those good arms, tweeting about those good arms, analyzing those good arms. It is the pitching ninja, analyst at MLB, Peacock, Fox, everywhere else, Rob Friedman. Rob, how are you this morning, man?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excellent. Man, got to ask you, we see you have made the joke before, you made the shirt, and then we see Chris Sale at the podium this week in the resting pitch face shirt. How cool was that for you? How fun a moment.
It's very cool. It's good to see that he's a man of his word. Like, he promised me that if we made the shirt, he would wear it, and he did. Like, I thought that was really cool.
So does this, obviously you are journalistic integrity, analyst integrity, all that stuff. You see a guy in your shirt like that, he's in the Cy Young race. Does that give you a little bit? I mean, the race is, it's Chris Sale's right now, but a little more juice for the race for you now?
Yeah, like, Chris Sale's always been one of my favorite pitchers to watch, like, you know, since he's been in the league. I just love his stuff and love the way he competes. So I was going to be a Chris Sale fan no matter what. And I'm in Atlanta, like, I don't have a choice. But, yeah, it gives me a little bit more of a bump on that. You know, obviously, Zach Wheeler's also a great pitcher. I don't choose between my pitchers generally, but we're rooting for Chris Sale.
Yeah, it's fine. It's also such a cool story. 2.46 ERA at age 35 when, you know, he wasn't done, but after a couple years of being injured, a couple years of not being all that effective, or at least not Chris Sale level effective, to come back at this level is a really cool story. What do you think's gone into that? What have you seen from him this year? You know, really, he hasn't pitched like this since he was like 29, and now he's doing it again at 35.
Yeah, so many different things, actually. Like, one is, there were definitely flashes of brilliance over the past few years when he wasn't producing the results. You saw that his fastball really didn't lose its zip, although occasionally wasn't able to keep it consistently high velo. This year he has just done a better job. I think having a full offseason of not being hurt enabled him to train a little better. He also, like, amazingly, and this blew my mind talking to him at the All-Star game, he changed the way he throws his changeup once he got traded to Atlanta. Like, an analyst said, why don't you try cutting your changeup a little bit to get seam shifted wake on it? And he didn't understand it, didn't know why he was going to do this, but trusted the analyst. And all of a sudden, his changeup was moving better, and it's made a little bit of a difference for him. Like, he loves it because he used to pronate his changeup to get more movement as opposed to now kind of cutting it. So little things. I think of Chris Sale as one of the more old-school pitchers in baseball, and for him to trust kind of new-school analytics, I thought was so cool.
Yeah, and this is, you know, obviously – every individual is going to have different utility for that kind of stuff. Maybe the term seam shifted wake, some guys are going to be like, get away from me with that. But then you show, it's like, okay, well, let's drop that term then. Let's drop the physics of it. Let's just get you throwing some and see how you feel with it. You know, I've talked to some guys who it's like, yeah, the analytics are great. And then, like, okay, when I step between the lines, I don't want any of that stuff in my head. It's helped me prepare and develop my pitches and things like that. So we'll probably see Chris Sale on Sunday. The Jays are down in Atlanta. This is a pretty good rotation overall. They haven't announced their starters, but it looks like we're going to get Max Fried, Spencer Schwellenbach, and Chris Sale. They also, of course, have Charlie Morton and Reynaldo Lopez in there. If the Braves can hang on to a playoff spot here, how confident are you in that rotation come playoff time compared to some of these other NL rotations?
They may have the best rotation going into the playoffs. And that's the thing, is getting there. Like, they're nowhere near a lock to get there, but there's not a team in baseball that wants to face Chris Sale in any game. There's just none, nobody. I talked to a lot of hitters. He is one of the toughest. He always comes up as one of the toughest pitchers to face. And you have Max Fried with his experience. Reynaldo Lopez has been tearing it up all year. And Spencer Schwellenbach is a guy that I don't think gets the national attention he deserves, but he's been really, really good. And then, of course, you're right. You have Charlie Morton, who has been there, done that, has the t-shirt and is still nasty. So yeah, they're a very good rotation, and the end of the bullpen too is very good.
Yeah, Charlie Morton, it's funny, it's Rich Hill has stolen his thunder a little bit, coming back and being the new old guy pitching, getting into a game again last night. When it comes to Schwellenbach, you mentioned you think he's a little under the national radar. We're talking like 370 ERA over almost 100 innings here, well over a strikeout per inning. What do you like about his package, about the stuff that we're going to see from him on the weekend?
He competes in the zone really well. His splitter's been very good. His makeup's just generally been, well, really, really good. Like, he started off a little shaky, and then I think he learned to not throw too good a pitch with two strikes, to try to get a chase sometimes. I know Tom Glavine had mentioned that at one point too, and it absolutely was a thing. Like, he was giving up too many two-strike hits. And just his, like, being surrounded, he's kind of like a sponge being surrounded by some really great pitchers. And it can't help but rub off on him. But he's also a really good athlete, throws hard. Like, I don't think he gets credit for throwing as hard as he does. He throws 97, 98 at top end and has excellent secondary. So, yeah, he's a guy to watch out for.
Yeah, and six different pitches that he'll mix in there as well. So he's got, it's kind of cool. Like, he's got the high velocity. He's got some of the newer school stuff with the splitter, but he's also a kitchen sink guy that's like, yeah, I'm going to, if he quote unquote learns to pitch and he has all those weapons, he could be really, really nasty. Like, you know, okay, what if Chris Bassitt threw 96? Unfair comparison, because Chris Bassitt throws like 30 different pitches, not six. But it does sound, you know, that idea of he's around Max Fried and he's around Chris Sale and Reynaldo, and he can pick up from Charlie Morton and guys like that. It does sound similar to what we've heard about here in Toronto with Bowden Francis, where Bowden Francis has, hey, Chris Bassitt, let me see what you're doing with a splitter. Kevin Gausman, let me see what you're doing with a splitter. I went pitching Ninja Mode at one point and I had him show me all the different grips he'd tried on the splitter before finding his. We won't see Bowden Francis in this series, but he pitched last night. What have you made of his breakout the last month and a half here?
It's so much fun. Like, they did a really good thing by tinkering with his pitch mix as opposed to working on mechanics in the middle of the season. Never really a good idea. Adding grips generally can be hit or miss, but eliminating pitches and concentrating on the things that are doing well has really simplified his approach and allowed him to be really, really confident up there. And you can see it. You can see on the bump how confident he is every time out there. His teammates are confident in him. And the ability to pick the brain of two of my favorite pitchers in baseball, two of the guys who think about pitching a ton, between Gausman and Bassitt, is incredible. Like, Bassitt thinks more than anybody. Like, you can see the little wheels turning in his head every time he's choosing a pitch.
So when it comes to Bowden Francis, obviously throwing that splitter a little bit more has been a key piece. We hear a lot, like, you know, splitter usage is up. I know you've talked to a handful of guys about, you know, how they throw the splitter, why they throw the splitter. Why is it that with that certain fastball type, because Bowden Francis's fastball results since he started at throwing the splitter have been much improved as well. What is it about how, you know, a splitter and kind of that like ride, high rise or low angle fastball, how they play off each other that makes them such an effective pair if you can learn the splitter?
Yeah, a lot of times is if you think it in terms of a hitter's trying to pick up on little cues. So as you're throwing a fastball, you're seeing more of the fat part of your hand coming through like that. Splitter's thrown the same way. You're not really manipulating the ball. You're just letting the grip do the work. So a hitter is seeing kind of the same thing in front of them, fat hand versus skinny hand when you're trying to throw a slider. So a lot of it has to do with that, as well as the ability of a splitter to have fewer rotations, meaning that it's going to tend to sink as opposed to a rising fastball. So you have that north-south attack, which really works well. They complement each other a lot, and it doesn't surprise me that your fastball would play better if you're concentrating more on throwing a splitter, because they are obviously very complementary pitches.
So when we look league-wide and splitter usage is up, but still not super, like, is that, there are so many different pitches, and I know you talk to a ton of guys about their grips and how they try to manipulate the seams and stuff. Is the splitter, like, is that the most fascinating one because it is so hard to throw and so many, you know, quirks to how a guy throws that?
That and the changeup, I think. Okay. There are a bunch of different ways to throw changeups, and you see some very successful changeup guys.
The Trevor Richards one where it's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't even know how his wrist works like that.
It's a lot like Devin Williams, the way he pronates through it. Devin spins it a little bit more, but Trevor is second. I mean, as far as like putting a ton of RPMs on the ball. That's one way to do it. And then you have the Chris Sale or Tarek Skubal way of throwing it, which is more seam shifted wake approach. And they're not doing all that. They're just throwing it to let the seams rotate the way they should. But yeah, I agree with you. Splitters probably have the most variety of grips, and you're going to see more of them because in Japan, it is like the national pitch. And you saw what Japan did in the World Baseball Classic to everybody. But everybody throws a splitter there, and they have gyro splitters. They have splitters that move all sorts of different ways. Here we just talk about a splitter. There they have categories of splitters. So you're going to see more and more of that. You may see pitchers throwing multiple types of splitters too. I think there's a lot of room for growth as far as splitters in MLB.
And it's cool. You know, it's upticked a little bit, but we're still talking about like, oh, 3% of pitches are splitters. And we know that, you know, as much as people are physically capable, it can be a copycat league. A couple years ago, is oh, everyone's going to toy with a sweeper. So, you know, more guys will show up next year trying to throw a splitter, I'm sure. You mentioned the Japanese influence. Natural transition then to Shota Imanaga, who not only has the nasty splitter and the invisible, that kind of rising fastball as well, but also threw 7 no-hit innings last night, and after the game was like, oh, I was throwing a no-hitter? Oh, I didn't even realize. Man, how much fun has he been to watch? And that start last night, just incredible stuff from him.
Absolutely. He's a ton of fun to watch. A lot of time on the mound, like, he doesn't throw a ton of different pitches, but what he does is he simplifies his game, knows what he does well, that fastball up in the zone with a splitter that complements it, occasionally throwing in some breaking stuff. But to me, both his mound presence as well as off the field stuff, dude is hilarious. Like, every interview he does is great. He's constantly trying to keep the press off balance with a sense of humor. And just enjoys himself. Like, he is a star as far as a person in the league. Like, he's must watch.
And what did he say last night? He got asked about the no-hit. He's like, yeah, it's like, I don't know, my third best thing since I came to the U.S. or something like that. So with that invisible he throws, obviously, you just kind of outlined for us the way that a splitter and a fastball play off of each other. But what else goes into making that fastball so tough to pick up for him?
Yeah, so that is one of the things that we're just starting to figure out. A lot of this stuff, because one thing that we haven't totally figured out, and this is a separate aside, is what we mean by deception in baseball. Like, what is a deceptive mechanic? Is it hiding the ball? Is it some kind of funk before then? He has that leg hang. Does that throw hitters off with, you know, they're not used to that? But the other thing he does, shorter guy, lower arm slot, gets good backspin on the baseball. And all that combined allows him from a lower arm angle to attack higher in the zone. When you have hitters that are trying to swing up on the ball, it intersects with the baseball a lot less if you're living at the top of the zone and your ball seemingly rises. It's just a good approach against that type of swing. He's a guy that I think a lot of us missed on because he didn't have the high top end velocity. He's not a guy that lights up the radar gun. But what he does light up is every other bit of our categorization of fastballs and what makes fastballs effective. And it was pretty easy to find out that his command as well as his fastball characteristics, we're going to be successful in the league once he started.
I mean, command, he's only walking like 4% of batters or something like that. It's pretty ridiculous. Okay, so he did come over, you know, at age 30. He turned 31 the other day. But we're also talking about, I mean, we've seen this before. He's got 153 innings. He's got a sub-3 ERA. Should he be mentioned in the Rookie of the Year race? Where do you land on like, oh, he's a rookie by the rule standards, but he's not a rookie in the kind of traditional sense. Because numbers wise, if Skeens is going to be in there, you know, Imanaga should probably be in the conversation too then, right?
Yeah, I mean, he definitely deserves consideration for Rookie of the Year. Right now you got like Jackson Merrill who's tearing it up too. As far as rookie pitchers, yeah, he's way up there. I mean, you have him, you have Mason Miller, I guess, is considered a rookie as well. But between Skeens' dominance is a different category to me. Like Skeens, you can see just shoves. He is a traditional rookie.
Yeah.
Doesn't pitch like it, has a totally different, like the most mature young pitcher I've ever talked to. Like absolutely incredible. But yeah, showed him he's a rookie. It does seem weird. 30-year-old rookie who had good stuff in Japan, professional league, but sort of minor leagues are professional leagues too. Yeah, I get it. I mean, but it is different from watching a pure rookie pitch.
Yeah, and, you know, the 40, 45 innings he's got on Skeens, whatever. Skeens ERA is like a run lower and he's blowing by everyone. There was a weird thing with Skeens last start with Doug Eddings, the umpire. I'm sure you caught that, where like the umpire was mad that Skeens thought he had a third strike. I don't know what Doug Eddings' problem with that was. He thought he had a strikeout. Just let it go. But that clip of that strike made me want to ask you, obviously, you know, you're the pitching ninja, but you watch a ton of this stuff. Do you have a favorite like pitch framer to watch, like a guy you think does it best or you know, pops up the most when you're looking at these things, help steal something on the edge?
Well, that's a good question. Jonah Heim is really good at that, obviously. To me, I look a lot at pitcher-catcher relationships in general, less so about framing. I mean, framing arguably is going to go away once we start with a challenge, or at least somewhat go away. I know. It is part of the beauty of the game, right? Yeah. I mean, it is a skill, too, that can be taught. So I agree with you that is a fun thing. But I guess no one will be upset if flopping went away from, like, soccer or basketball. So, you know, you got to get the call right. If the ball's over the strike zone, should be called right. But what I love to watch are pitcher-catcher relationships. Like, Adley Rutschman is one of the guys, to me, that has a great relationship with his pitchers. You can tell when a pitcher needs a kick in the butt versus, you know, pumping him up, say, hey, you know, and he is one of those guys. So I look at them as being the general on the field as well as the skill behind the plate. But really, those are the things that jump out at me about catchers.
Okay, I got a couple quick ones for you before I let you go here. Ben Joyce threw 105.5 miles an hour the other day. You also posted a clip of a guy named Johnny Cannon who threw 97. But should Ben Joyce get to take the name Johnny Cannon, since that fits a little better for a guy throwing 106?
Oh, without a doubt. Although I did nickname him the Volunteer Fireman, which is a great nickname, right? Like, that's a good nickname.
Yeah, I think it's a good one.
He's from Tennessee.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good way. Did he play at Tennessee, too, or he's just from there?
No, he played at Tennessee, okay. And was an athlete. He threw 105 at Tennessee, too. So this wasn't new stuff for him. I interviewed him when he was in college. Great makeup, like stud in the weight room. He's one of those guys that he will live in the weight room. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him throw a legit 106 with no roundups or anything.
Unbelievable. That's it's ridiculous that human bodies can do that. Jeffrey Springs is back. Looks like back. Obviously, that's more of a 2025 development for that team. What have you seen from him? Obviously, when healthy, one of the more fun guys to watch.
Yeah, he's interesting because he is, to me, a changeup guy. I love his changeup. I think his changeup is one of the more underrated pitches in baseball. I like the fact of a guy that gets it done without ridiculous velocity and they just pitch. Like, I love watching Chris Bassett pitch, for example, like a guy that has a mental Rolodex of a million pitches and goes, I'm going to throw this exactly right here and get the result I want. It's almost like, watching a painter with infinite colors in their palette versus guys that are just throwing paint anywhere. So he's one of those guys that I like watching for that reason.
All right. And then this is an open-ended one. We've mentioned a couple guys that you feel are a little under the radar, Spencer Schwellenbach or something like that. Is there a pitcher right now that you think is not getting enough attention for how good the stuff is or how much fun he is to watch?
So Ryan Nelson is one of the guys that I consider candidate. Yeah, I consider him to be a breakout candidate, especially for next year. I see him getting confidence. He throws hard and has, you know, very crisp pitches. And I just don't hear a lot of people talking about him generally, maybe outside of the D-backs. But, yeah, he's one of those guys that I think deserves some credit. Also, I think, like, Ronaldo Lopez deserves credit for being absolutely dominant this year. And, you know, people still aren't processing how good he's been.
Yeah, look, both of those guys, we are a couple weeks away from those teams potentially both being in the playoffs. Now, who knows? Ryan Nelson maybe moves to the – we'll see if they move into the pen or what they shake out there. But these guys are going to have some moments, especially if the Braves hang on there. So should be more eyes on those guys soon. Rob, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Rob Friedman, the pitching ninja. Of course, you know his stuff from Twitter, MLB, Peacock, Fox, everywhere. You're the best, Rob. Thank you. Rob Friedman, pitching ninja. Yeah, a lot of fun stuff there. A lot of tough pitchers ahead for the Blue Jays this weekend. The Braves have not confirmed their starters, but if they stay on term, it'll be Max Fried, Spencer Schwellenbach, and Chris Sale. That is a nasty 1-2-3 for a series here in September. It's a pretty nasty 1-2-3 if you were to run into them in a playoff series. But something to watch is that The Braves are no longer assured of that playoff series. Their lead on the final wildcard spot in the National League is down to half a game because the Mets have once again gotten hot. They've won seven in a row. They just swept the Red Sox. Our pal John Morosi was there. It was the MLB Network Showcase Game of the Week, and I believe a TBS game as well. So let's take a break. Let's talk to him. Let's check in on that Mets team. Let's check in on, we don't need to check in on the Red Sox side. They're done. They're toast. We'll talk about the Matt Chapman extension as well. 6 years, $151 million with the 151 or 115? What am I losing in my notes here? 6 year extension for Matt Chapman. 151, right. Okay, 6-151 for Matt Chapman. We'll talk about that with John Morosi as well. We'll whip around. We'll talk to Jesse Rogers of ESPN in the second hour as well, and we'll take some of your texts to 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus rolls on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
In-depth Blue Jays coverage with an analytical twist. Jays Talk Plus with Blake Murphy. Be sure to subscribe and download Jays Talk on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays lose last night 4-2 to the Phillies. They get swept 2-0 in that one. A lot of interesting stuff happening in the NL East, even though the Phillies have pulled away there with a 7-game lead, including the New York Mets pulling back within half a game of the Braves for the final wild card spot because the Mets have won 7 in a row and the Braves are pretty banged up. John Morosi was, I believe, at Mets Red Sox this week as the Mets swept it. He joins us now. John, how are we doing?
Blake, how are you? I was actually not at that Mets-Red Sox game, but I would have loved to have been there because, of course, you got the 86 World Series rematch, and you've seen two teams moving in very different directions there with the Red Sox plummeting and the Mets really challenging those Braves that you just mentioned.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. They've won seven in a row now. They're only half game back. Man, high level, what do you think? Can they pull it off? Like, this is obviously a Braves team that has a pretty good rotation, even though their offense is banged up. The Diamondbacks and why am I drawing a blank? And the Padres.
The Padres
are not too far away. Can the Mets pull this off?
I think they can. And it's to me, I look very closely at that NL East conversation. I almost put the NL West teams in a different category where the Padres and D-backs have both played so well that I would say they're probably in. And that means that it's the third and final NL wildcard spot that could be up for grabs there between the Braves and the Mets. And right now, Blake, the momentum belongs to the Mets. Francisco Lindor is putting together an MVP caliber season. What a glorious year that he's had, and in power and on base and defense, everything that Lindor brings. He right now is, I think, the best player in the NL in the non-Shohei Ohtani division, so to speak. And I think in that setting, you look at what Francisco's been able to do. And then David Peterson, too, with what he's done. Yeah. I think he has really put together a phenomenal year with the Mets, a little bit of an adjustment to his pitch mix has been really good for him. Sinker, changeup, both. I think he's able to pronate very well, as a pitching coach would say now, in terms of that same side of his hand, if you will, as he's delivering that baseball. So sinker, changeup work really well together. And Peterson, I think, has become one great illustration of the way that David Stearns's administration has had a lot of success in year one.
Yeah, it's fun to see, and yeah, Peterson's been cool. Tyler McGill back up is, I know he hasn't had quite the results, but anytime a guy's like almost 7 feet tall on the mound, it's pretty. That whole McGill family, giant pitchers, all of them. I wanted to go back to Lindor there. 5 30 home run seasons at the shortstop position now. I believe two off of A-Rod's record with 7 30 home run seasons there. By wins above replacement, he's on track for this to be, and this is crazy to say given how good he was back in his Guardians time, like 2018, like the best season of his career. You mentioned it, the non-Shohei category. Do you think he could, like, especially if the Mets take this spot, he's going to be 30-30. He's going to be an eight-win guy. Is there enough there, or is Shohei going 50-50 that this is open and shut?
No, I think it's close. It's a really interesting debate. And let's look at it this way, Blake. If you are someone who values up-the-middle defense highly, which a lot of baseball people do, and especially if it's up-the-middle defense for a team that, if they cross the finish line, they make the playoffs largely because of what he brings to them in the middle of the diamond. It's not a far-fetched argument at all. I think there may be some that say, listen, if Shohei gets 50-50, it's hard to not vote for him, and I certainly respect that. I also want to make the global point here in the MVP conversation that it's not as though it's a Shohei or Lindor conversation and then you are somehow discrediting the person that you put second on your ballot. I've never really understood that. It's not as though – now, if someone – really makes a strange ballot and has Lindor first and Shohei 10th or vice versa, then we'll have a conversation. But I think that this is a case, much like the American League, candidly, where you've probably got two right answers here. And it's just really a matter of how you value the defensive contributions of Lindor. Because I think it's very easy to argue right now that in terms of total offensive impact, Shohei really is in a category unto himself at this moment in time, but he's a DH only. And there's a reason why it's been especially difficult for any pure DH to win the MVP. It's because it's the most valuable player, not the most valuable hitter or offensive performer. And that's where you could certainly bring in the defensive ability. And Lindor is not just, he's not just a shortstop. He is an elite defensive shortstop. And I think that's where, much like Bobby Witt Jr. in the American League conversation, it does introduce a lot of interesting thoughts.
And it's so fun, right? Because like in your, like you're right, Lindor might win. I mean, Ellie De La Cruz and Dansby Swanson will be in there too, but like he could win the Gold Glove. Like by the defensive metrics, he's right there, if not number one among NL shortstops. And like, there is a reason Marcell Ozuna has like an outside shot at the, well, he's too far behind on home runs now, but for a little bit there, it looked like he might win a triple crown and nobody was talking about him on their ballots because you're a DH. That's how big the bar is. But, you know, if we look at, say, Fangraphs, how they value this stuff, Shohei has been worth two more wins than anyone else just as a hitter and then also might steal 50 bases. It's a crazy, both races are crazy where Shohei could go 50-50. Judge could top his 62 home runs. It's man, what a fun, as Lindor has said recently, the MVP's won in August and September. And it makes for some really fun baseball down the stretch here, in addition to the pennant race or wild card race that the Mets are in too.
Well, no, it's a great point, Blake. And I've been an MVP voter in the past, and I have intentionally, when I've had a vote, I really try to not do too much granular work on the candidates until really September 20th, thereabouts. Yeah. Because I don't want to have, and this is my own philosophy, some people might disagree with this, I don't want to have a preconceived notion in mind before all the ballots have been cast, so to speak, before we have all the information. And because, and again, if a player comes up and in September is the reason why his team wins the division, or the reason why his team gets a playoff berth and maybe the other competitor fades a bit down the stretch, you have to keep an open mind for this. And I'll pound the table on this, Blake, from now until the end of time, that it is still the value of the player to his team. And what that is exactly what it says on the ballot, the value of the player to his team. And I have always said, and my colleague Joel Sherman has said this years ago, and I think it's a very fair point, the player is most valuable to his team when he helps that team win. I'm not saying that there have been times where the best candidate, all things considered, has been someone from a team that missed the playoffs, and I certainly am open-minded to that. But if I look at it, Blake, I tend to give, as a voter, I give bonus credit, I give extra points, however you want to describe it, to the players who are the difference-making players that get your team into the postseason, or do something like what Mookie Betts did years ago when he was protecting David Ortiz. How do you do that as a young player? That's an amazing thing that helped that team get to the playoffs. I've always been a believer in Jose Ramirez. If you remember years ago when Josh Donaldson got traded from Toronto to Cleveland and Jose Ramirez says, yeah, I realize I'm an elite third baseman, but I'm going to play second base to help my team get better and allow Josh Donaldson to play for us. I took that into consideration when I filled out my ballot. I have respect for other people that look at the ballot differently and just vote strictly on the numbers. I am not one of those people. And That's how I look at my ballot.
I mean, that's how Mike Trout ends up with, you know, the best decade of baseball that maybe we've, you know, until Shohei and Aaron Judge came along, the best decade of baseball we'd seen in a while, and three MVPs, right? Like 8-7 win seasons, but three MVPs because the Angels were bad. It's not his fault, but you got to split the hairs somehow. Jose Ramirez, by the way, who is not going to win the MVP, but is headed for his 7th top 10 finish in MVP voting, and maybe like his 5th top 3 finish. What a guy.
He's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
He's a Hall of Famer.
He's awesome.
And that's where, and again, that's where I love being able to vote on the yearly awards. And then I also am really grateful that I get a Hall of Fame vote because they are related, but not the same. And it's the job, I think, of the Hall of Fame voter. And by the way, it's all selected from the same body of people. They're all the baseball writers. So the baseball writers, if you're covering the sport on a consistent basis, you're a member of the local chapter, you can have a vote, depending on what the chapter chairperson decides, for the annual awards. We've got four of them that we vote on. MVP, Cy Young, Manager of the Year, Rookie of the Year. That's the annual voting. To get the Hall of Fame ballot, you've got to be a consistent baseball writer for 10 years and then remain connected and continue to cover the game after that to have that Hall of Fame ballot. And what I've always looked at it as, it's almost like the Hall of Fame is the final exam, right? The annual awards are like the quizzes or the midterms that are sort of accumulating and adding up to the overall body of work. But in some ways, the Hall of Fame, the final exam, if you will, you can do better on the final than you did on the individual midterms. That's how you get people like Scott Rolen being a deserved Hall of Famer. It's the body of work. And that's where, for me, I look more at exactly what you're describing in Jose Ramirez's case. I care more about top 10, top 5, top 3 finishes than necessarily how many times did you actually win it. Because it's more along the lines of, have you been an historically significant, relevant player to be in that MVP conversation every year for basically a decade? Jose Ramirez has met that standard irrespective of how many times he actually wins the award. And for that reason, I think clearly, Blake, he's on his way to Cooperstown.
Yeah, I think so as well. And it's, you know, you'd love to see some Cleveland playoff success at some point, some big runs there. But yeah, I think he's already at 6 All-Star appearances. Like I said, this will be his 5th or 6th top 5 finish, his 7th top 10 finish. He's ridiculous. Okay, let's pivot off the voting stuff. A little bit of news overnight in that Matt Chapman signed a 6-year, $151 million extension reportedly with the San Francisco Giants. So he will not, I guess technically he'll have to opt out of year 2 and year 3 of this contract and then sign the new one here. What do you make of that one? The fit seems really good. Chapman's having a good year. That's a big number for a guy already into his 30s.
It's a big number. I think the trust there between him and Bob Melvin is really important. I also think it's unique that it's happening, Blake, at a time where there's a lot of questions about the future of the Giants front office and if there might be some changes there. But obviously the trust is certainly in place to sign someone who's been a very valuable player. Interesting to note too, Blake, that the numbers that Chapman is signed for now with the Giants are not that far off what had been reported as being what the Jays had offered Chapman at different times. He sort of bet on himself, and it took him some time. It didn't feel like he was going to win, but he has. And I think that's an important mark of credit for Chapman, and congratulations to him and his family on making good in the end, because I'm sure there were some nervous times where reportedly, again, he had turned down a fairly significant offer from the Jays, and he was able to make that money back with the Giants. So great fit. The team in general there, Blake, is kind of still in transition. It's amazing that you've got three teams in that division likely heading to the playoffs, and the Giants are still not one of them, where the Padres, with their aggressiveness, and you've got to credit A.J. Preller. He makes life interesting. The Padres are getting themselves into the playoffs more than likely. The defending NL champion Diamondbacks have, after stumbling early, gotten themselves back into the conversation. And the Giants are just decidedly mediocre. They're not a bad team, but they're not a playoff team. And they haven't been for a while. And I think that is one of the reasons why I think Chapman is part of the solution. But I'm just not sure what their path looks like to getting back to the postseason if you cannot make it in a year in which you're probably going to have three teams from your division in the postseason field.
Yeah, and some uncertainty there as well, where Blake Snell has the ability to opt out after the season, and you know, the farm system's not bottom of the league, but it's not everyone knocking out. Tyler Fitzgerald's already here, right? Like, Elliot Ramos is already here. So some questions to answer there. When you look, this is a little bit early for this question, but you know, we're in Toronto. We got to start looking at 2025 free agency already here. The infield market, now that you take Matt Chapman off of it, thins out pretty quick. Alex Bregman's obviously the top of it. Ha-Sung Kim is not a third baseman, but he has played third base in the past and is so good defensively, you could plug him around. But if you were a team that, say, needed to add multiple impact bats this offseason, and let's assume Juan Soto lands with the Yankees, how difficult do you think that's going to be to have an offseason where you come away with two real impact bats this year?
Well, it's interesting that you frame it that way, Blake, because I think it actually opens up a lot of interesting trade conversations. And that, I think, leads right into the Bo Bichette piece of all this. Because if teams are pessimistic about their chances of landing the big free agent, this is maybe where you take a big swing and try to trade for Bo. I realize he's coming off a down year. We all know that. But again, at a time where you're probably acknowledging you're not able to get a player of Bo's ability when he's at his peak, unless you're going to pay top dollar, it's a bit of a leap of faith. And when you look at the other options, and by the way, Ha-Sung Kim has had some injury issues this season. Alex Bregman with the elbow has had some significant, I think, worrisome injuries there when you think about his ability to potentially play that position long-term. He's described the issue with his elbow as being gremlins in there. I'm not sure. I think my wife's anatomy books are around here somewhere. I'm not sure if gremlins, there's an entry in her book about what she was taking in medical school, if that's an actual diagnosable condition. Does he mean bone chips? Maybe. And if that's the case, one would assume that he'll be able to get that taken care of this winter and then get back in time for next season. But again, if the gremlins are more significant than that, you do wonder about that. So I think for a lot of these reasons, Blake, it's an imperfect time to be looking for a free agent infielder. And I think that you raise a very good point that maybe this actually would improve what probably to this point has been a rather complicated trade market for Bo Bichette.
Yeah, and then that's one component of it. And if you're the Blue Jays and you want to keep Bo Bichette and you want to try to compete in 2025, and you're worried about feeding the gremlins in Bregman's elbow after midnight or getting them wet or whatever makes the gremlins go evil, it's suddenly thin there. The other obviously big question for the Blue Jays this offseason is going to be Vlad. You and I have talked Vlad extension stuff in the pretty recent past. So we don't need to go over all of that necessarily. But since the All-Star break, he leads Major League Baseball in hits, extra base hits, average, slugging, OPS. He's now up to fourth in Major League Baseball in overall offense on the season, and I think 11th in position player wins above replacement. Does make it easier to work out those kind of things because you're seeing what Vlad is? Or is it just, you know, price going up, price going up, price going up? How do you contextualize Vlad being hot at, for extension purposes, absolutely the right time?
I think it's the latter. It's going to make it more expensive and probably more complicated. I do believe, and multiple people have said this to me during the course of the season, he truly does want to stay in Toronto, but obviously the next part of that sentence, the clause is, comma, if the money is right. I think that's always the supposition whenever you talk about a contract of this magnitude. I do think, and I will believe this until proven otherwise, that we're not probably going to get a ton of movement on the Vlad contractual front until Soto signs.
Right.
Because they're so similar in terms of overall profile, age, track record, value in the marketplace, potentially both playing corners. There's just so many similarities there that I think that if I'm Vlad's agents, I just wait. I say, we'll have this conversation, but I want to see where we know what Soto's free agent number is, and then we will adjust off of that with our number. And if Soto's number is as massive as we all expect it to be, there's not going to be any discount coming for Vlad with the Blue Jays. And so I think it is a fascinating discussion. I think that we'll continue to have it because you look at what Vlad's able to do. And I think in general, the numbers are giving you proof of concept, to use the term, that this is who he can be. And he was not just a creation of the one great year that was played in minor league ballparks. He's been, based on OPS plus, better now than he was then in terms of what his overall park and league adjusted numbers look like. So he's special. And we're talking about these unique players. And we at the beginning of the conversation, we touched on Shohei or Lindor, Ramirez, Judge, Witt. Vlad is in that class right now. And he's one of the 10 best offensive players in the sport. And if you look at this team, I'm of the mind that we've seen enough good glimpses from the young players in this group that you can dream a little bit on Barger and Wagner and Horowitz to make an impact on this team next season. And so if that's the case, you can talk yourself into believing that this team with some modifications is a competitive one in 2025 with Vlad. But in the same breath, I would acknowledge that without him in 26, if you don't have him, I question seriously how competitive they'd be, which I think really illustrates the urgency, Blake, of the point that you just made.
It gets bleak in a hurry in 2026 if he's not locked up. We're talking about, hey, Jays Talk Plus needs to be a one-hour show, not a two-hour show, if him and Bo are both out of here. This is a little aside the point, but Bobby Witt Jr.'s hitting 339. Vlad's hitting 328 now. Think there's a chance he can catch him? Like, do we have a batting title race on our hands here? Or is that, you know, Bobby Witt's too... He's Bobby Witt. It's a tough one. How do you see that shaping up the rest of the way here?
Sure. I think certainly it's a possibility that Vlad could catch him. And those are fun. I remember covering years ago, Maglio Ordonez going for a batting title. And when you're covering someone going for a batting title, it really does present a lot of interesting coverage options. Every at-bat matters, no matter what's going on in the situation of the game or where the standings are at a given time. I certainly think you look at the ballpark elements, and Vlad is in a more hitter-friendly ballpark than Witt is, although in the case of Witt, his offensive game, because he is so line-to-line and he can get so many leg hits and he can – what he does with just hitting the ball all over the place, it's almost like Kauffman Stadium has no impact on him. He's just special no matter what. And oh, by the way, when Bobby Witt gets a single, it's actually a double because he's going to steal second base very quickly. So he's such a delight to watch. And I do think now the one thing I'll say that makes it interesting, you wonder if Bobby Witt Jr.'s number of at-bats will start to slow down if the other teams pitch around him because of Pasquantino's injury. And if Bobby Witt Jr.'s is not going to see as many pitches to hit, I think in the case of the Jays, they're out of it. And if it's a team that's out of it that's playing the Jays, you maybe not going to pitch around Vladdy that carefully because you want your younger players to get tested and see how they do against an elite player in a situation like that. So Vladdy might have a higher number of at-bats than Bobby Witt Jr. does. And obviously then it becomes a math equation, which I've always said, Blake, I never do math on the air. So I'm not going to violate that right now, but I do think that could create for some interesting arithmetic down the stretch. If the number of ABs for Witt, it becomes a little bit lower than you'd expect.
Yeah, I'm okay with some math on the air, but I'm going to save that for like last week of the season. You know, I'll put a little chart up or something like that. It'll be, you know, similar to the Maglio Ordonez Ichiro year. Now, those guys were hitting at a higher clip than Bobby Witt and Vlad, but still the same kind of thing. Oh, if Maglio goes, you know, 8 for 25 this week, what does Ichiro have to do? That kind of thing. We'll have some fun with it. That was the year, right? The year he hit 363?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
07. I remember we were, we ended the season in Chicago, Tigers, White Sox, and we were at that same time following very carefully the West Coast results for Ichiro. So great memory there. And by the way, Tigers, White Sox is the final game, final series this year as well. And one only can wonder what history or what numbers, I'm putting in air quotes for those listening to us on 590, what numbers the White Sox might be chasing at that moment in time.
Yes, baseball provides many different types of history, and Chicago-Detroit is possibly going to present some there. We're talking like 130 losses there, maybe. John Morosi, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Blake. Keep up the great work, and look forward to the next conversation. Thanks,
John
so much.
Morosi of MLB Network, NHL Network, of course, as well. Yeah, we're going to head down to Chicago actually after the break. We're going to talk to Jesse Rogers of ESPN, who is ESPN Chicago. So Cubs, Shota Imanaga, no hitter last night, which, by the way, should point out, Nate Pearson has been really good after that first blip with the Cubs. We obviously, you know, had a little bit of a chuckle when he, you know, first outing allows a home run, hits a guy, strikes a guy out as well. Kind of the Nate Pearson hat trick there. He has an ERA of 2 and change there and was part of an historic, the 21st combined no-hitter in MLB history last night, along with Shota Imanaga and Porter Hodge, who is just a wonderful source of holds if you are in such a league and fighting for those down the stretch here. Nobody cares when I bring something like that up. But yeah, we'll talk Cubs. We'll talk White Sox pushing for history. ESPN also had all of their baseball people make some September predictions the other day. We'll go over some of those with Jesse as well because we don't have a game to tee up tonight. We'll also take a couple of your texts to the text line, 590, 590. Standard data and message rates may apply. All that's coming up as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
Your daily dose of everything NFL. It's the Fan Checkdown with Matt Marchese and Donovan Bennett. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A lot of fun stuff around baseball. Last night, the Jays lose, of course, but Shota Imanaga is a part of the 21st ever combined no-hitter in baseball. He hands it over to Nate Pearson, who hands it over to Parker Hodge. They get it done. Lots of stuff going on in Chicago in general. The White Sox are on a torrid one-game win streak to get their record back to 32-109 here and almost get the run differential back on the good side of negative 300. Let's go down to Chicago. Let's see what's going on there. Let's talk to Jesse Rogers of ESPN. Jesse, good morning. How are we doing?
I'm doing well. Good to be with you.
How is being there, covering a combined no-hitter? We have been on the wrong side of a few traditional and combined no-hitters here in Toronto over the last couple years, but haven't been on the good side of one. How was it?
Well, a couple things. First of all, it was good for the fans because I didn't even realize until we were getting late that it's the first one thrown by a Cub or a Cub team at Wrigley since 1972. Now, they've been no-hit by other teams. They've thrown no-hitters on the road. Technically, they threw a home no-hitter, but it was up in Milwaukee because of issues. They had to play a home game in Milwaukee, and it happened to be a no-hitter a few years ago, and I was at that one. But at Wrigley Field, first home no-hitter since 72, so the fans got a treat. But let's face it, a combined no-hitter where the starting pitcher leaves even before he hits the century mark is a little bit of a letdown. It's a little bit of a letdown. The funniest part of all these things, and this actually happened the last time the Cubs threw a no-hitter, and that was a combined one, is pitchers involved in the no-hitter didn't know there was a no-hitter going on, including Shota. Shota Imanaga says he did not know until he came out of the game, and Craig Counsell came up to him and wasn't exactly smiling like you think he would after 7 shutout. Counsell had a little pained expression because he was ready to take out a guy with a no-hitter, and he had to tell him. And Shota didn't get it until after the conversation. It's amazing. He didn't know it, and I believe the catcher didn't know it either. So it's crazy, but I guess that's how focused these guys are. So it was kind of cool, but it would have been much cooler if Shota could finish. And so what if he throws 120 pitches? Now, I say that, you know, knowing that Tommy John is around the corner for anybody. But so I would say it was kind of cool compared to really cool.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like, we just went through the other week, Bowden Francis was allowed to go into the ninth inning seeking a no-hitter and threw, like, by far a career-high 117 pitches. And then next time they were out, they were just like, yeah, okay, he's only going to throw 70 this time. Now, the Blue Jays are not kind of in a wild card race the way the Cubs are. The Cubs were up 11-0. Maybe that had an impact on it. What was the explanation after the game? Just too risky to let him go north of 100, given where, what is it, his career high is like 103 pitches or something like that?
Yeah, it's the first year of a long-term deal. It's his first year coming over from Japan where they pitch once a week. You see every team that has a new Japanese player, meaning a first-year guy, they really take it easy. It's been well documented. There's no time zones in Japan where they travel. They pitch once a week. They're off on Mondays. Everything is scheduled out. So even if he isn't surpassing his innings total from his years in Japan, it's still a different grind here. And who knows, maybe this is different if it's in the last year of his contract or last year of his career, and they just, oh, what's the difference? I really don't think the wild card race had much to do with it. I think it's just his long-term health and the score probably. Like, is it really worth it to squeeze two more innings? But it is interesting when managers are faced with this decision, they really make it an inning early. They don't wait until after the eighth where the crowd is really going to go nuts. He's at 105 or 108, and you really got to make a tough decision. They do it early enough after seven that he's not on the verge of it, so he can sort of get away with it. I always find that interesting because, of course, he had one more inning in him. It wasn't the one more inning Craig Counsell was worried about. It was the two innings. Yeah. It was the eighth and the ninth and getting to 120 or more or whatever. So it's a little disappointing. I mean, we know in the old days, I don't care if a guy was from Japan or wherever, Mars, he would have finished. He would have tried to finish, but this is not the old days, and the data suggests, you know, Tommy John is around the corner. So, I mean, on one level, I get it, but as kind of, I'll just say, a meatball fan, I wanted to see it happen, you know?
Yeah, I'm always rooting for that over, you know, I mean, how often do you get a chance to be a part of history like that? And then to the point of they didn't notice, I wonder how much of that is that Isak Paredes just kept putting guys on base for them. Yes. So they weren't hits, but three errors for one guy in one game. The other part of that, so Parker Hodge was a part of it, and then our old friend Nate Pearson threw an inning of that as well. He obviously didn't have the best start for the Cubs, but he's been really solid for this team. What have you seen from Nate Pearson since they picked him up?
I mean, as you'd imagine, just this live arm. I mean, he's a huge, huge individual, and the Cubs love the velocity. They need it. They've been searching. They've been turning over their bullpen and trying. You know, Porter Hodge is another example. Just they haven't had velocity in their bullpen for years, while everybody else seemingly has. So this is your classic, you know, change of scenery. If it wasn't the Cubs, it would have been somewhere else. And I think they're going to take the offseason to examine exactly what they can get out of Pearson. But I think he's been okay. It's such a different vibe when you're not the phenom on the block like he was in Toronto, like this live arm, big, big sort of name prospect. Here he comes in under the radar. And I like the arm, but it has to be harnessed. And I think the Cubs are going to, you know, really examine him in the offseason. But it was interesting they went to him, you know, with the no-hitter. Obviously, the game's well in hand, and he was able to pitch a clean eighth inning. So, jury's still out, but I do like the live arm, which is not an observation that's really over the top. So we'll see.
Last one on the Cubs here. I mean, they win yesterday. They're 4.5 out of the wild card. They've got the Yankees and Dodgers back to back here. Are they pretty much toast? Like, how much hope is there? And I know Justin Steele's on the IL now too. How tough is this going to be if the Cubs are going to try to pull this off?
I think pretty much toast covers it. Their odds, and I'm not a big odds guy, but they dropped to like 1% at this point. I mean, they had a killer. They needed everything to go right, and it was for a while. And then they had a killer loss on Monday, up 3-0. They were kind of due for one, but because they've been going so well. But just because you're due doesn't mean it has to happen. So that loss was followed up by another one, you know, against Paul Skeen. So they're pretty much cooked. I don't deny they could have some good moments against the Dodgers and Yankees. The Rangers just beat them, I think, 2 out of 3, if I'm not. And Washington beat the Yankees 2 out of 3. It can happen. So, but to think they're going to go through two series and sweep them like they just did on the road, that's a different story. I mean, you're hoping to split against those teams. And splits aren't good enough. So, yeah, they're pretty much toast, barring some incredible miracle. And, by the way, the Mets never lose, and the Braves have righted the ship since last month. So, you want to call playing out the string. Maybe that's a little too strong. But they really need to be perfect the rest of the way, and I highly doubt that's going to happen.
Yeah, it's a tough road back there. Elsewhere in the city, potential history being made. The White Sox won their most recent game to get back to 32-109. They are almost 50 games back of the division and 44 back of a playoff spot. What have you felt the pull to go to the South Side a little more often, given even though it's not the type of history we always hope for, that's real history in the making the next couple weeks there potentially?
Well, I felt the pull because I've been assigned to it. It's not something you want to do, but yeah, I'll be covering history soon enough here in the next week to 10 days. It's crazy that the question of whether they'll set the worst record of all time isn't a if, it's a when. Like, it's a fait accompli at this point. You know, that's something that should come down to the final series or final couple games. It's not going to happen. They're going to blow by 120 losses despite winning yesterday. So, yeah, I'll be there for it. It is historic in a way. I mean, only one team can have that mark, and the Mets had it, at least in the modern era, 162 games, and the White Sox are going to set it. It's just crazy that the amount of losing they've had, you know, the 21 in a row, 12 in a row, another 12 in a row they just broke yesterday. It's something we've never seen in our lifetime. So it is historic.
Anytime the Cleveland Spiders name starts coming up, you know you're in a bad way with, yeah, three 12-game losing streaks in the same season. Jesse, pivoting to another team that's had a tougher season, you had a great piece on the Texas Rangers earlier this week at ESPN, and obviously that is a Rangers team not nearly as bad as the White Sox, but coming off a World Series, for them to be not even competitive in the playoff race here is a bit of a surprise. Obviously the talent's there, the payroll's there still. What has gone wrong for the Rangers this year? What can we learn from how difficult it is to repeat here in 2024?
It's really, really interesting to me. This is an interesting topic. The most interesting thing that came out of it in talking to Chris Young and even other executives is the toughest part is the young players, getting them to sort of repeat their seasons from the previous year or take another step. You would think it'd be the older players, but Corey Seager and Marcus Semien don't need to be told how to go about their business repeating. They are veterans, high price. They know how to get their bodies ready. It's those younger players that kind of think they've arrived after winning a World Series and maybe have dollar signs in their heads. Like, I talked to a bunch of executives about it. And if you look at it, Jonah Heim, Josh Young, I mean, you go through the list, Adolis Garcia, you know, Evan Carter, whoever it is, young players expected to at least contribute, or guys that did have good years, they just didn't follow up. They regressed. And Chris Young was very honest about that. So to getting those sort of arbitration eligible players who are still building their careers to take another step after winning the World Series, I think is a challenge for any executive to remember as they embark on a repeat. And then you have to have some health. I mean, Bruce Bochy mentioned health, surprises, and then young players taking another step to have big years. And he gave me the direct quote: "We didn't hit on any of that." So you need a little bit of everything. Now, look, you need a little bit of all that in a regular year, but I think it's especially so in a repeat year because everyone is gunning for you. So you better have things locked down in all these different areas, including surprise performances. And they frankly on the record said they didn't get it. So there are lessons to be learned. Now, why we haven't had a repeat champion since 2000, no one could specifically say. But I'd say probably the amount of injuries teams sustain sort of mitigates everything. Like, even if you're ultra talented, like the Rangers, they've had injuries on the mound and at the plate, and that's enough to derail a team trying to repeat. And then you add on these other things like young players not taking steps, and you see why maybe in 25 years we haven't had that repeat champion.
Yeah, it's tough. We barely even have repeat teams go back to the World Series. Like 27, 2018 Dodgers are the last team to go to the World Series years in a row. The Royals in 14, 15 before that. So, yeah, we're at a point where, you know, maybe the Giants winning every second year for a couple years is the best you can hope for, or, you know, the Dodgers and the Astros of recent vintage getting to the show a couple times in a five-year window. Like, that's what, you know, the word dynasty won't exist anymore in baseball, but that's, you know, hey, can you get there a couple times over a five-year span, over a 10-year span? That's kind of the high watermark. And then I guess, too, the addition of the extra wild card spots, if you don't get that bye through the first round, adds an extra layer of kind of randomness, right, where even a very good team won't win a 2 out of 3 series all the time. That's probably going to have an impact moving forward as well, right?
Definitely. With or without the bye, just adding two more teams in each league to the playoffs, just it makes it more difficult. Let's face it. You're either, if you are a wild card team going through four rounds, even if you have the bye, you might be facing a really hot team that just won the wild card. It's more uncertainty the more teams you throw into the mix. So, yeah, I agree with that. It's real difficult. And I do find it interesting, you know, like the Royals went 1 year and then it sort of had that motivation for the next year. Like, they didn't win and then lose. They lost and then win. And I see the Diamondbacks, like, they very well might lose and then win. Where here the Rangers won. Like, it's even harder to win and win again or go back. I think there's that chip on your shoulder if you lose you have a better shot at going back. So let's see what the Diamondbacks do this year. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to take a impenetrable type team to go back to back. Maybe the Dodgers are that team this year. Health is going to be so huge come this year because everybody is so tight. The Dodgers were beat up last year. Atlanta was beat up last year. It really opened the path for Arizona. So let's see who's healthy in about a month.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that none of us can predict, right? You can model, you can look at the rosters. You can't predict who's going to tweak an oblique in an at-bat a couple days from now. Jesse, I was curious about something you wrote. This is a couple weeks ago now. I know you've talked about the potential six-inning minimum for starters that MLB floated as a potential idea. You've talked about that enough, but I'm curious, a couple weeks in, what was the feedback you received? Like, once you put that piece out there, once that news was out there, you talking to other writers, talking to players, talking to other execs and league people, what has the response been generally to that idea?
Well, a couple, three thoughts. It's been wide ranging. There are people within the league that really like the idea, and there's even people within the league that are kind of like, and that kind of mimicked what the response out there was. Now, pitchers loved it, essentially, because they want to throw six innings. So it forced the manager to leave them in at that critical 93 pitch mark, third time through the order. They love it. They love it. Now, they kind of wouldn't mind a little pay for it. Like, hey, if I'm reaching 180 to 200 innings, how about a little bonus like they do with pre-arbitration? Like, there's all sorts of thoughts, but most of the players liked it. They don't have a problem with it. Managers and executives were a little bit like the league. Some liked it, some didn't. Managers don't like strategy being taken out. Executives didn't mind it so much because it's a level playing field. It's the same for everyone, kind of like the rule changes from last year, though they are trying to solve for winning championships, and it may not be the best way to win a championship, but it's definitely better aesthetically for the sport. They all agree with that, eliminating openers and stuff like that. Fans were definitely split, as fans are. Knee-jerk reaction was they hated. And then when they looked under the hood a little bit, I think more people liked it, understanding there are carve-outs. If you throw 100 pitches, if you give up five runs, it wouldn't really come into play on a daily basis the way most people think. If you're going well, a lot of times you will pitch six innings anyway. It's just more about training habits. That was the key. Just let it filter all the way down to high school. We want to train for six innings or more. And then, again, it would take away that analytical moment the third time through the order. Guy's going pretty well, but he has a history of giving it up. You're forced to leave him in. So, I think more people liked it than not when really they thought about it, but I don't think it's going to happen. And if it does, it's not going to happen anytime soon. So let's put it that way.
Yeah. And I think it's a good conversation starter, right? Like, how do we get the incentives back where you're training for longer outings and you're not training for 100% max every time? How do we get a little offense back in the game? Obviously here in Toronto, people don't like the second time through the order thing because of what happened in the playoffs last year. You know, how do you mitigate some of those things? And obviously pitcher injuries is a factor in that. So I'm in favor of anything that's going to get us talking like that, get the ball rolling on some idea generation. Jesse, I know you guys at ESPN did a bunch of September predictions. I won't ask you to rehash them here, but I will ask you this one. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has closed the lead in the batting title race in the American League to 11 points. It's 339, Bobby Witt Jr., 328, Vlad. Do you think he can close it?
For the batting title, yes, I do. I don't think he's going to overtake Bobby. I thought you were going to ask me about like MVP voting. I mean, we pretty much know who's got that.
Yeah, I mean, you guys were so unanimous in that ESPN poll that, I had it on my list to ask you, but yeah, you guys were almost unanimous already, so.
Yeah, I mean, the big question is, does Witt overtake Soto or Soto overtake Witt for second?
Oh, interesting.
Will teammates finish one, too? I think Witt probably does finish second. I think Vlad can do it, but I wouldn't say Bobby Witt's going to give it back. Vlad's going to have to take it. Because Bobby Witt is no fluke. So this isn't some guy coming out of nowhere to win the title. So I think it's going to be tough. 3 weeks to go. There's always 10 points down.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But I think Vlad's going to have to just go on a hot streak to take it.
Yeah, it's always a lot of fun. I love a batting title race down the stretch here, especially if the MVP race is not entirely locked up. But again, you guys had it fairly unanimous the other day at ESPN. Jesse, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. Great convo. Be well.
Jesse Rogers of ESPN. And again, with our pal Kylie McDaniel and a few others at ESPN. great list of predictions up over there for the rest of the season, including, yeah, they're pretty much unanimous on Shohei over Lindor at this point, on Judge over Witt at this point. Now, some of them can't talk about it publicly because, again, as we've discussed on the show, as we get closer to award season, if you have a vote for an award through the BBWAA, you're not supposed to technically talk about that until after your ballot is submitted and all the ballots are submitted and things like that. For not that anyone would think otherwise, but I do not have a vote, by the way. I could talk about all this stuff. I don't have a vote in the NBA either. I could talk about all that stuff. Do whatever I want when you don't have a vote. What I want to do right now is I want to take a couple questions in the text line. I promise you we do that. You can always text us 590, 590. Standard data and message rates may apply. Someone who didn't sign there has asked, did the Jays mess up by not upping their offer to Chapman before 2023 or early last offseason? 6-150 looks pretty good for a guy that's going to have 6 WAR this year. It's tough because, you know, these things, the reporting on these things never comes out completely cleanly, but it does sound like the Jays prior to 2023 made a very competitive offer to Chapman, more than he got this offseason, certainly. But Chapman went the bet on yourself route. Would I go 6 years, 151 for Chapman, or if you include this year, it turns into 7, 169? That's a lot for a guy who's already 31. I'm a big believer in the glove holding up, but obviously we've seen, you know, when the bat isn't all the way there, you know, that's more of a 3-win player. He's also not a 6-win guy right now. Maybe that's a baseball reference. Fangraphs has him at 4.5. Either way, splitting hairs there. It's great for Chapman. It's a lot of bank, but the third base market's thin, man. Yeah, it's the third base market is thin in a hurry after Alex Bregman this year, unless you're going to move some guys around positionally and things like that. Brendan from Stony Creek asked if I could choose available free agents this offseason to sign outside of Juan Soto, who would it be? Bregman's top of my list. I know there's injury concerns with respect to that elbow, and does that change his ability to stick at third base? At least over the next couple years, I think, you know, that guy, given the team's need at third base, is, unless you believe Arelvis, but it didn't seem like they believed the defense at second, at third base. Like all these prospects that are fringy that have come up, the team seems to believe most of them are second base / left field guys, not full-time third base guys. And that even applies to Addison Barger, who I get the impression they like him more as an outfielder than a third baseman. We'll see. So Bregman's probably close to the top. I think Santander is next, but maybe if Ha-Seong Kim's healthy and you do some funky stuff positionally, like the defense with Ha-Seong Kim is just so good. And I would love to add another I know the lineup absolutely needs power, but to have another contact-oriented guy who can hit near the top of the order and set the table for a guy like Vlad, you know, if Santander is not there, or if, you know, you don't want to go to the next tier down of power hitter, the Eloy Jimenez types, you know, maybe go that way. Okay, Devin from Aurora had asked, being realistic, who do you think is realistic or is possible for the Blue Jays this offseason starting pitcher-wise? Nick Pivetta is probably the highest name. I have no idea what his market's going to be, given that it's years and years now of his actual results being solid, but all the underlying stuff being like, no, he's better than this. He's even better than this. The fastball's unbelievable. He should be better. Do you bet on that? Do you pay for that? It only takes one team. Further down, I think it's probably more realistic that the Jays aim for, like, fifth starter types where, oh, if that guy loses out on the rotation battle to Bowden Francis, Yariel Rodriguez, Jake Bloss, he can move to the bullpen. You know, maybe that Michael Lorenzen tier of guy that isn't all that sexy, but would add to your bullpen depth, if not your starting depth. I think that's probably more realistically where they're shopping, because the work that they need to do is more significantly on the hitting side. That person also asked, can they make the playoffs next year? Is it years away? Yeah, they can make the playoffs. I mean, there are bad teams that are going to make the playoffs this year. It's not easy to make the playoffs, but to get back to from a 73-ish win team to an 85-ish win team, when you bank in, hey, we're not going to sell, you're not going to quote unquote tank, you're going to play your best lineup every year, you're not going to shut guys down, etc. It's the legwork to get back to where you can believe in a playoff berth is not that hard. What is difficult is to get the legwork back to, hey, do I believe this team can compete for a World Series? That's the one where I'd have to see a lot of offseason moves, or you just get very lucky. Jason at Dartmouth had asked, percentage chance Vlad's the third baseman full-time next year. Is Pete Alonso an option to play first base? I think that's basically the only scenario where Vlad plays third base, is if the only thing you can get in free agency is a big bopping first baseman. Even then, I'd be more tempted to go first base / DH with those two guys, because Vlad's defense at third base, as much as it's a fun experiment, it's not good. It's not a thing you want to do full time. Back in 2019, he was the worst defensive player in baseball. I think if he played there for a full season at third base now, it would be close to that as well. It's fun. He's not awful play to play. But yeah, that can't be your plan A. That has to be a backup. And then Grecian in Toronto says, I have just one request for Blake. Can you please have a great day? Anytime you hear from the doc in the mailbag, in the text line, it's a great day. So thank you, Grecian. Okay. Thank you to Subway for bringing the crew some food this morning. I didn't get in on that, but everyone upstairs where they can actually access food and don't have to talk for 2 hours, they are eating Subway Canada today. Subway Canada has just rolled out a brand new 4-inch breakfast sandwich and snack, which is on a new ciabatta bun. Whether you're powering through the early morning rush or need a mid-show snack like them, that hits. These bite-sized beauties are the perfect solution, starting at just $3. Your wallet will love them too. Thank you to them for feeding Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick upstairs. Thank you to Jesse Rogers, John Morosi, the Pitching Ninja, and Keegan Matheson for joining us today. Jay's not in action tonight, but we will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to set up Blue Jays and Braves for you. That one gets going in Atlanta starting at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Hope you all have a wonderful Thursday. Talk to you tomorrow.